This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's Friday, which means it's time for our weekend review, and we begin at the State House, where the Massachusetts Senate unanimously passed a bill that would ban drivers from using electronic devices behind the wheel except in hands-free mode. Senate President Karen Spilka says the move is long overdue.
We've recognized that there are many many drivers out there that are seriously distracted. I think we all see that on a daily basis, and that we need to make serious changes.
For advocates like Emily Stein of the Safe Roads Alliance, this is a matter of saving lives.
We keep meeting more families who've lost a child or a sibling or a parent, meeting people who've been seriously injured after being hit in a crosswalk.
The House passed a similar bill last month, and Governor Charlie Baker also appears to be on board with a distracted driving ban. Here he is speaking to Channel 5 in March.
The data that shows the number of texting while driving incidents has gone up dramatically.
Still to be decided before a ban becomes law, how to address concerns about racial profiling. We turn now to our Week in Review panelists. Susan Tracy is president of the Democratic consulting firm The Strategy Group and a former state representative. Hey there, Tracy.
Thank you.
Susan Tracy, I should say.
Okay, no worries.
And also
the
with
first
us,
person
I know, that. Right? I'm sure that. And also with us is Richard Tessay. He's the former minority leader of the Massachusetts Senate. Welcome back, Richard.
Nice to be here.
All right, so let's start with this distracted driving proposal. If this ban becomes law, Susan, Massachusetts would join more than a dozen states that already have some version of a ban like this in place. Do you think it can actually be effective? Because we keep in mind Massachusetts already has a texting while driving ban, so this is sort of an incremental increase, or would be. What do you make of it?
Well, I think it's not going to be effective unless you implement it. So I think, you know, time will tell. But I think anything that starts to, you know, I have a daughter who's just going through driver's ed and taking her license. I think if we start teaching kids at an early age to pay attention to this, I think the more attention and certainly sort of repercussions for not doing the right thing, I think are good in the long run. And I think the vote tells you that. It was 155-2 in the House. There's strong support for doing this.
And you're saying if, though. Do you have some doubts, though, about whether this will actually get signed into law?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I thought you said, would it be effective?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
so
I see. Okay.
Absolutely, it'll be signed in.
You think it's pretty much a done deal?
I think 155-2 vote is, and a governor speaking in support of it, is a done deal.
And what about you, Richard? I mean, is this going to be a difference maker?
I think it's a good thing, public policy-wise, for the state to do, and it sends out a clear message. I think the Senate president was right when she said that this is long overdue. This is a question of, I think, the technology is a lot further ahead than the lawmakers, and it has become a pretty bad problem. I know there are a number of deaths and accidents that are attributed to people just being distracted because of their, you know, everybody has their iPhone attached to them all the time. So I think this is a good thing, and it will end up saving lives and injury and cut down on accidents.
Well, you're sort of behind the technology. I mean, this has been a long time coming, as Susan points out. I mean, this is a popular bill right now, but this has fallen apart in previous sessions. I'm thinking especially of someone like State Senator Mark Montigny, who's been a longtime supporter of a bill like this. In fact, he's been filing similar legislation since 2003. And to your point, Susan, he says it's not just a matter of safety, but also enforceability.
It's just as dangerous to dial the digits as it is to text anyway. But it also is a disincentive for law enforcement. They're not pulling over people in the numbers they should be because they know that somebody will claim that they were dialing, and then you have to subpoena records and go to court. So we ended up tying law enforcement's hand behind their back.
So what about that, Susan Tracy? Does this actually make enforcement easier? Because as the senator is saying, you know, you could maybe say, oh, I wasn't texting, I was just ringing a number, and now you can't say that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the reason that it's probably taken so long is because of things like that, concerns. And it's funny, if you know, Richard knows this, if when you're drafting legislation, lots of people have different opinions on how to make it work and why it's not going to work. I think they clearly have got to a place on this bill where they've got comfort level with the law enforcement community, with the minority community. And, you know, if there are things that aren't perfect in this, we can go back and fix it. But the real issue is getting it on the books, and let's get started on this.
Richard, what do you think about the enforcement aspect of this? Is this going to be an extra tool that will make things easier for law enforcement?
I mean, it's not a hammer. I think you need three offenses to get a surchargeable offense. I think it's a $100 fine, $250, and then $500. So, you know, you're giving people a lot of chances. But I think that you know, as important as the message that it sends out. And, you know, and that is to elevate this whole issue, to make people more conscientious and recognize that, you know, you shouldn't be just proper driving habits and, you know.
It's the right thing to do.
And we all do it. So this is good, for, I think, for everybody to make sure that, you know, everybody stops and pauses and recognizes this and hopefully changes their habits.
Hey, you got to use that handy hands-free button in there in the car now. But as we talk about enforcement, though, I mean, I'm mindful that a lot of lawmakers have been and continue to be concerned about the possibility of racial profiling. That's been a holdup of the bill or versions of the bill in past sessions. Some lawmakers fear that it won't be applied equally to all motorists if a ban goes into effect. Last year, for example, former State Representative Byron Rushing was among those who was most concerned about police behavior and traffic stops. And here's what he told us on Radio Boston last July.
Those of us who support ending racial profiling have taken a position that we would not support any primary enforcement by police until that primary enforcement was directly connected to ending and making illegal racial profiling by Massachusetts police.
So Byron Rushing is not in the House anymore, but those concerns linger, Richard, to say. And I would point out that one of the sticking points right now is that you've got different enforcement measures in the House version of this ban or proposed ban and the Senate version. So the Senate's version would track race and ethnicity of every driver who's pulled over for allegedly driving while distracted. The House version would track the race and ethnicity only for the drivers who were actually ticketed. Does one of those strategies make more sense to you than the other, Richard?
I think both the House and the Senate are in the right lane, you know, as far as considering racial profiling and, you know, the fact that this law could lend itself for people being pulled over for those reasons. So I think having a reporting component, I think the Senate is obviously more expansive and probably the, you know, I want to say the better of the two, personally, I think.
Says the senator.
Says the senator.
The Senate's always right. No, it's probably a little stronger than the House, and that's going to be worked out in a conference between the House and the Senate. I don't think that will end up holding up the bill, but that's really the only difference between the two bills right now.
Well, you know, just to put some particulars to it, you know, Senator Montigny has said that the concerns about racial profiling might be overblown. But, Susan Tracy, there is some evidence to support the idea that racial profiling does go on in traffic stops. A couple of years ago, for example, Channel 5 analyzed a decade of Massachusetts state police traffic stops, so some 3.5 million stops altogether. And the conclusion was that black drivers are searched at twice the rate of white drivers, and Hispanic drivers are searched at 3 times the rate of white drivers. So, you know, I mean, searches and you know, texting while driving or calling while driving, I mean, not exactly the same thing, but this is a concern rooted in data.
Yes, and I think that's why you saw this bill that seems on its surface to be something that should have passed, why it's probably taken a little bit longer. I think, you know, Byron Rushing spoke to it. I'm sure this was an issue that's been a source of contention within the branches with some advocates, and I think finding the common ground on that piece that's in the House and the Senate will be critical. And again, I would always say that, you know, the goal here is to save lives, right? That's the goal of this legislation, to have safer driving. And if there are components of a piece of legislation that in time we realize maybe we could do this a little differently or this could be better, we can always go back and fix it. But let's get the primary goal and piece of legislation on this in law. And if we need to come back again and fix some things, we can.
Well, you're leading me to another law enforcement topic that I think will also be kind of an iterative process that may be edited as we go on. I'm thinking of this week's rollout of body cameras for Boston police. So this week, about 200 of Boston's more than 2,000 police officers began wearing body cameras as standard gear. Officers wearing the cameras are expected to record almost all of their interactions with the public unless they stop recording at the request of a civilian or when a victim is giving their first account of a crime. And Mayor Marty Walsh hopes that this will increase transparency and improve community relations.
The complaints against police officers in Boston has been down for the last 5 years. You know, I don't think this isn't the answer to everything, but this is another piece of a very important process.
Richard Tessier, do you think that the mayor is right there? This is going to be an effective strategy to, again, improve relations between police and the communities?
Yeah, I think from a public relations standpoint, it's good. And it's also good, I believe, for the police, too, just to protect them and for people to be able to see what actually happens in controversial situations. And I know that this was very controversial at the beginning. The union pushed back against it, and the pilot is starting now, but there's already been a study that they've been able to gather some data from, and it's not, you know, and I think it's going to be the data was positive, and I think rolling it out to a bigger universe is going to be a good thing for the police and for Boston.
Yeah, just to fill in some detail on that, a pilot program. So a Northeastern University researchers broke down the results of that pilot. And what they found was that officers who were wearing body cameras during the pilot received fewer citizen complaints, and they also generated fewer use of force reports relative to officers who were not wearing cameras. So small sample size in only 1 year, but some encouraging signs there, Susan Tracy.
I think it is absolutely the right thing to do. I think the public wants it. I think it's in the best interest of police. And I would add, you know, we just spent a lot of time talking about phones and driving. Everyone, every one of us has a video camera in our pocket right now. So the ability for the public to videotape any interaction is so great. So why not actually have a formal process of videotape? And I think the devil will be in the details. There's going to have to be some strong standards and some strong criteria for what do we do with these videotapes? How long do we keep them? How do we use them? So I think, you know, there's going to be something, you know, there are going to be details to be worked out, but this is the right path to go on, and it's in the best interest of public safety, and I believe it's in the best interest of police officers, too.
I think one of those details to work out, right, is the level of privacy involved. This is one of the concerns that some people have. For example, the officers can operate their cameras with or without the consent of people being recorded, even inside somebody's home. At least that's the way it's set up right now. Shagun Idowa, who's the co-founder of the Boston Police Camera Action Task Force, recently told WBUR that his group is lobbying for the policy to require consent.
Our policy called for consent, even on the street, but we were fine to accept notification on the street, but consent in the home. But according to this new policy, consent is not required at all during any interaction, no matter where it is.
So what about that, Susan Tracy? I mean, so that could be one distinction. Maybe if you're just walking around the street, you just notify people, hey, you're being recorded. You don't have to ask for their consent, but in their home you do. Does that make sense?
Well, I feel like part of this feels like a modern-day expansion of Miranda rights. You know, as a society at one point decided we have to tell people what their rights are. And maybe there is a way to have some type of uniform system that is known to people in an interaction with a police officer. Again, I think this falls a little bit into the category that we just talked about, which is, you know, the devil's in the details. There are some details to be worked out. But the greater issue, whether it's, you know, distracted driving, as we just spoke about, or in this case, improving the relationship between the police and the community and having, you know, kind of validation of interactions that are good for all parties, I feel like that's what the goal is. And if there are details that we have to work out or legal issues that have to be considered in that, I feel like we can get there.
Richard, you noted some resistance among some police officers at the outset of this experiment. But at this point, Police Commissioner William Gross is saying that he actually welcomes these body cameras because he thinks it'll give the public a better understanding of how police do their jobs.
Oftentimes, we just see little excerpts of this and that, and it doesn't fully tell the entire story. We're looking forward to the program. Wait until you see how we're treated sometimes. Wait till you see our video. You're going to be like, wow, they are human.
So what about that, Richard, to say? I think you suggest maybe we'll see some body camera footage of, you know, an officer keeping his cool for a change.
I think some of the initially the police were, you know, standoffish about this, and some aren't opposed. And the more, especially having the pilot, the more they've seen this, I think that they've recognized that this could actually be, you know, a very good thing for them. And, you know, just to get back to what you were saying earlier, I do think there has to be a little bit of flexibility given to the police officers to be able to get, you know, witnesses to talk to them without worrying that they're being recorded on camera. you know, victims, the same thing. If something just happens, I doubt you're going to be more, you know, and you're not at your best state, or if you're, you know, you're not going to want to be recorded. So I would give the police the discretion as to when, you know, when the cameras are on and off, and see how that works out.
All right. If police are walking around the city right now with body cameras on, those cameras will invariably pick up a lot of footage with rainbows in the background, right? Because it is June, it is LGBTQ Pride Month, and Boston has been celebrating all week. In fact, the city will be awash with rainbows and revelers at the Boston Pride Parade and other celebrations tomorrow. But Pride Week has not gone off without controversy, starting with the Providence, Rhode Island Bishop Thomas Tobin's tweet over the weekend saying that Catholics should not support or attend Pride Month events held in June. His tweet went on to say that Pride events promote and encourage activities contrary to the Catholic faith and are especially harmful for children. This generated quite a strong response on both sides. We heard from some, like Providence parishioner Tyler Rowley, speaking with Rhode Island's NBC 10, saying that Tobin's message is right on.
I think it's bad for children to see half-naked men running around, whether it's at a Pride rally or whether it's in my neighborhood. I don't want children seeing that. And I think he's speaking to the types of things that go on.
But Rhode Island Pride President Joe Lazzarini denounced Tobin's tweet in an interview with news talk station WPRO.
He is attacking the LGBTQIA plus community. And that's why we called a spade yesterday. And we went after him for his words and for his hate and for his bigotry, because that's exactly what it is. And that's why he should step down and resign from as Bishop of the Catholic Church.
Now, Tobin did later come back with a statement saying that he regretted the tweet, was so controversial and offensive to some, but he also said that he, quote, felt that his obligation before God is to lead the faithful, entrusted to my care, and to teach the faith clearly and compassionately, even on very difficult and sensitive issues, end quote. Richard Tessay, what was your reaction to this controversy at the beginning of the week?
I'm not on Twitter, I'm not on Facebook, but it seems like a perfect Twitter.
Congratulations.
And Facebook.
Good for you.
Manufactured almost crisis. You know, I'm not surprised. You know, obviously, all of the bishops were very much against marriage equality when it came out, and, you know, advocated very strongly against it. You know, they have 1,000 years of church policy behind them. So when the bishop came out with this tweet, you know, he's a Catholic bishop sending out a tweet to his Catholic
following.
Why anybody should get upset about it or pay any attention to it? You know, you don't have to. And hopefully people aren't going to get worked up about it and have a great Pride weekend. You know?
But it's worth noting there isn't even unanimity among Catholics on this issue, though. I mean, for example, on Monday we spoke with Mary Ann Duddy Burke. She's the executive director of Dignity USA, which is an organization of Catholics working for LGBTQ rights. And she says the tenets of Catholicism are about love and respecting the dignity of all people, and that Bishop Tobin isn't expressing that.
The bishop way overstepped his authority, his realm of expertise. He went out of his way to cause pain for a group of people who often feel vulnerable already in society and really feel vulnerable in our church.
So what do you think, Susan Tracy? I mean,
a couple of thoughts. One, Bishop Tobin is one person in a pretty big church. He is not speaking for everybody. And I say that both among priests and nuns and among the faithful. One. Two, I found the most offensive part of that tweet, and where I did feel like, whoa, was talking about pride being harmful to children. In light of the sex abuse scandal, I could not reconcile how it just seemed so hypocritical and so wrong. And that to me was the moment in the tweet that I kind of hear you, Richard, like he's one person and, you know, don't be surprised, but that to me crossed the line.
Yeah, the context is striking, of course, as you say.
Absolutely.
With the clergy sex abuse in the background. If we try, Richard, to take it in a vacuum, though, I mean, is there any merit to what Tyler Rowley said? He's the parishioner we heard from a moment ago saying, look, I'm not sure that to all of these events, maybe it's a pride parade, are the right place for children. Now, keep in mind, we can turn on the Olympics and see barely dressed men as well in Speedos and whatnot. But, I mean, does he have any merit there to say, yeah, maybe this isn't the best environment for children?
As a parent, you have to decide what's age appropriate for your kid, and you know.
Yeah, he probably shouldn't bring his kids to the Pride Parade if he's concerned. You know, that's what I would say.
But what I'm hearing, though, is that this should be a household decision or for even within Catholics for you to make up your own mind as opposed to a sort of one mandate coming down from on high.
Clearly, there's diversity in the Catholic Church on this. And there are a lot of, as I said, great priests and nuns who put Christianity and what I was always taught, which is, you know, we're all God's children first.
And I have to say, there's a lot of change going on within the church right now. They're probably behind the public as a whole, but I think they're making steps. I mean, when you have the Pope coming out, who's obviously more liberal than the previous Pope on these issues, who am I to judge?
Right.
I think that things are headed in the right direction, but it's definitely baby steps, but that has to be worked out within the church, not the government.
It's kind of like the legislature. There are a lot of different opinions.
And a lot of layers to the story. I mean, one other thing that came up this week, too, is that while we have the Pride Parade in Boston tomorrow, there has at least been talk of another Pride Parade to be organized. This is the so-called Straight Pride Parade. This is a group of men who are seeking a permit from the city of Boston to hold an event in August. And they say that it will, quote, be held to achieve inclusivity and spread awareness of issues impacting straights in Greater Boston and beyond, end quote. Now, there was, as predictable, a backlash on social media, which apparently Richard was fortunate enough to miss, unplugging himself from that world. But I'm curious what you make of this, Richard, because the response from these organizers was, look, we're sort of, doing this tongue-in-cheek, but they're also say that they're, highlighting what they see as a real issue that, straight people are under attack here as well.
I think it is. I mean, they're basically.
Your face says it all right now.
They're basically trolling everyone.
I can confirm that.
I doubt that there's it's probably two or three guys in a room just having fun on Twitter and, actually hitting a nerve and boom, there you go. And, I think the mayor obviously ends up on the hot seat. And I think it's important for him to almost call their bluff because, if they want a permit for the parade, let them take it.
Seems to kind of what he was doing, by the way. On Twitter yesterday, the Boston mayor, Marty Walsh, said, quote, the city of Boston cannot deny a permit based on an organization's values. And then he added the Straight Pride Parade doesn't yet have a permit, but is working to amend their application for permits to host a public event. And then he went on to invite folks to stand with the LGBTQ community in celebrating Pride this week. So is that the right strategy then, Susan Tracy, to just let them have their permit? And
Much ado about nothing. This is three people. They are probably cackling that it has been raised to a point where we're talking about it and the national press has picked it up. If these guys want to march around on a parade route with the three of them on August 31st, I say go for it. I have no problem with it. March away. I'll probably be away. I'm sure it'll be very crowded downtown with all the traffic for the parade. Who cares?
One other note on Pride Week. This year's occasion aligns with the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots in New York, which was a turning point in the fight for LGBTQ rights. And in May, we spoke with Connecticut College professor Jim Downs about what this anniversary means for people who were celebrating their identity today.
Part of the fight for gay liberation was writing their own history to prove to future generations that gay people weren't just an aberration in the way that doctors or lawyers or even religious authorities demonized them.
So how about that, Richard? I mean, he's sort of saying, look, there's sort of a long arc here over the last five decades, and that perhaps we should just look at something like this, hubbub about Tobin at the beginning of the week as like a blip on the radar.
That's how I look at it. I mean, I served in the legislature 26 years. I want the most interesting and most important vote I took was for marriage equality. And just to see that happen during my lifetime, where 10 years ago, or even less, that was just something that was unheard of. And now it's so normal and, accepted and boring. It's just tremendous progress has been made. And I feel very fortunate to be living in the period of time that I am.
Yeah, same here.
All right. So these were some of the big headlines that dominated the news this week. But there are always those other fun or interesting items that maybe slip below the headlines. I'm thinking of our hubbubs, and we've got a couple of minutes for those. Susan, what do you want to put on our radar that maybe we missed?
Well, I think people might already know this, but for those who don't know, today's National Donut Day, first Friday in June. little history. It goes back to 1938 after World War I. The Salvation Army started National Donut Day in recognition of their volunteers who gave out donuts. So if you haven't heard about it, I think there are some places giving away free donuts. So you got a few hours left. Let's go.
Sounds like a high holiday to me. And Richard, how about you? What's on your mind?
If you run across a $20 bill and Andrew Jackson isn't there and it's Harriet Tubman, don't be surprised. It's still a legal tender, legitimate $20 bill, but it's probably the work of the Jamaica Plain Hope Central Church. And they're frustrated because Harriet Tubman was supposed to be on the $20 bill. It hasn't happened yet. It's taking a long time. So they decided to take this whole process into their own hands and developed a really good stamp that blots out Andrew Jackson's face and puts hers right in it. And we'll see how many they can.
Get my tub in 20.
Yeah, we'll see how many they can produce.
The Treasury is saying we'll have to wait until 2026, I think, for the rest of us. But then it's coming right now. My hubbub is somewhat sports related. We'll be talking about the Bruins later. But here's a more uplifting item. The Bachelorette, Hannah B. One of her remaining suitors went on a date with her in Boston this week, and they ended up at a shoot around in the Celtics practice facility with Jaylen Brown and Terry Rozier. And after they shot hoops, the Bachelorette asked for a little love advice from Jaylen Brown.
What do you think I should look for in a man?
Somebody that makes you laugh, somebody who you can be yourself with, somebody who respects you, somebody who's there for the rough times and the good times.
Deep thoughts there from the Celtics, who are not in the NBA Finals, Susan and Richard, so they've got time. That's Susan Tracy, president of the Democratic consulting firm The Strategy Group and
Thanks,
state rep. Also with us was Richard Tesei, former minority leader of the Massachusetts State Senate.
Nice to see you guys.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston.